We do not intend, of course, to proceed with our travelers throughout the vast series of adventure encountered in their passage through the wilderness. To the curious in these particulars, we recommend the book itself. No details more intensely exciting are to be found in any work of travels within our knowledge. At times full of life and enjoying the whole luxury to be found in the career of the hunter, at times suffering every extremity of fatigue, hunger, thirst, anxiety, terror, and despair, Mr. Hunt still persisted in his journey and finally brought it to a successful termination. A bare outline of the route pursued is all we can attempt. Proceeding up the river, our party arrived on the 28th of April at the mouth of the Nebraska, or Platte, the largest tributary of the Missouri, and about 600 miles above its junction with the Mississippi. They now halted for 2 days to supply themselves with oars and poles from the tough wood of the ash, which is not to be found higher up the river. Upon the 2nd of May, two of the hunters insisted upon abandoning the expedition and returning to St. Louis. On the 10th, the party reached the Omaha village and encamped in its vicinity. This village is about 830 miles above St. Louis and on the west bank of the stream. Three men here deserted, but their places were luckily supplied by three others, who were prevailed upon by liberal promises to enlist. On the 15th, Mr. Hunt left Omaha and proceeded. Not long afterward, a canoe was descried navigated by two white men. They proved to be two adventurers, who for some years past had been hunting and trapping near the head of the Missouri. Their names were Jones and Carson. They were now on their way to St. Louis, but readily abandoned their voyage and turned their faces again toward the Rocky Mountains. On the 23rd, Mr. Hunt received, by a special messenger, a letter from Mr. Manuel Lisa, the leading partner of the Missouri Fur Company, and the gentleman who rendered him so many disservices at St. Louis. He had left that place with a large party 3 weeks after Mr. H., and having heard rumors of hostile intentions on the part of the Sioux, a much-dreaded tribe of Indians, made great exertions to overtake him, that they might pass through the dangerous part of the river together. Mr. H., however, was justly suspicious of the Spaniard and pushed on. At the village of the Poncas, about a league south of the river Quicor, he stopped only long enough to procure a supply of dried buffalo meat. On the morning of the 25th, it was discovered that Jones and Carson had deserted. They were pursued, but in vain. The next day, three white men were observed in two canoes descending the river. They proved to be three Kentucky hunters, Edward Robinson, John Hoback, and Jacob Risner. They also had passed several years in the upper wilderness and were now on their way home, but willingly turned back with the expedition. Information derived from these recruits induced Mr. Hunt to alter his route. Hitherto, he had intended to follow the course pursued by Messrs. Lewis and Clark, ascending the Missouri to its forks, and thence by land across the mountains. He was informed, however, that in so doing he would have to pass through the country of the Blackfeet, a savage tribe of Indians, exasperated against the whites, on account of the death of one of their men by the hands of Captain Lewis. Robinson advised a more southerly route. This would carry them over the mountains about where the headwaters of the Platte and the Yellowstone take their rise, a much more practicable pass than that of Lewis and Clark. To this counsel, Mr. Hunt agreed and resolved to leave the Missouri at the village of the Arickaras, at which they would arrive in a few days. On the 1st of June, they reached the Great Bend of the river, which here winds for about 30 miles round a circular peninsula, the neck of which is not above 2,000 yards across. On the morning of June the 3rd, the party were overtaken by Lisa, much to their dissatisfaction. The meeting was, of course, far from cordial, but an outward appearance of civility was maintained for 2 days. On the 3rd, a quarrel took place, which was near terminating seriously. It was, however, partially adjusted, and the rival parties coasted along opposite sides of the river, in sight of each other. On the 12th of June, they reached the village of the Arickaras, between the 46th and 47th parallels of north latitude, and about 1,430 miles above the mouth of the Missouri. In accomplishing thus much of his journey, Mr. Hunt had not failed to meet with a crowd of difficulties, at which we have not even hinted. He was frequently in extreme peril from large bodies of the Sioux, and at one time it was a mere accident alone which prevented the massacre of the whole party. At the Arikara village, our adventurers were to abandon their boats and proceed westward across the wilderness. Horses were to be purchased from the Indians, who could not, however, furnish them in sufficient numbers. In this dilemma, Lisa offered to purchase the boats, now no longer of use, and to pay for them in horses to be obtained at a fort belonging to the Missouri Fur Company and situated at the Mandan villages, about 150 miles further up the river. A bargain was made, and Messieurs Lisa and Crooks went for the horses, returning with them in about a fortnight. At the Arikara village, if we understand, Mr. Hunt engaged the services of one Edward Rose. He enlisted as interpreter when the expedition should reach the country of the Apsarikas, or Crow Indians, among whom he had formerly resided. On the 18th of July, the party took up their line of march. They were still insufficiently provided with horses. The cavalcade consisted of 82, most of them heavily laden with Indian goods, beaver traps, ammunition, and provisions. Each of the partners was mounted. As they took leave of Arikara, the veterans of Lisa's company, as well as Lisa himself, predicted the total destruction of our adventurers amid the innumerable perils of the wilderness. To avoid the Blackfeet Indians, a ferocious and implacable tribe of which we have before spoken, the party kept a southwestern direction. This route took them across some of the tributary streams of the Missouri and through immense prairies bounded only by the horizon. Their progress was at first slow, and Mr. Crooks falling sick, it was necessary to make a litter for him between two horses. On the 23rd of the month, they encamped on the banks of a little stream nicknamed Big River, where they remained several days, meeting with a variety of adventures. Among other things, they were enabled to complete their supply of horses from a band of the Cheyenne Indians. On the 6th of August, the journey was resumed, and they soon left the hostile region of the Sioux behind them. About this period, a plot was discovered on the part of the interpreter, Edward Rose. This villain had been tampering with the men, and proposed upon arriving among his old acquaintances, the Crows, to desert to the savages with as much booty as could be carried off. The matter was adjusted, however, and Mr. Rose, through the ingenuity of Mr. Hunt, quietly dismissed. On the 13th, Mr. H. varied his course to the westward, a route which soon brought him to a fork of the Little Missouri, and upon the skirts of the Black Mountains. These are an extensive chain lying about 100 miles east of the Rocky Mountains, stretching northeasterly from the South Fork of the River Platte to the Great North Bend of the Missouri, and dividing the waters of the Missouri from those of the Mississippi and Arkansas. The travelers here supposed themselves to be about 250 miles from the village of the Arikaras. Their more serious troubles now commenced. Hunger and thirst, with the minor difficulties of grizzly bears, beset them at every turn as they attempted to force a passage through the rugged barriers in their path. At length, they emerged upon a stream of clear water, one of the forks of the Powder River, and once more beheld wide meadows and plenty of buffalo. They ascended this stream about 18 miles, directing their march toward a lofty mountain which had been in sight since the 17th. They reached the base of this mountain, which proved to be a spur of the Rocky chain, on the 30th, having now come about 400 miles since leaving Arikara. For one or two days they endeavored in vain to find a defile in the mountains. On the 3rd of September they made an attempt to force a passage to the westward, but soon became entangled among rocks and precipices, which set all their efforts at defiance. They were now, too, in the region of the terrible Apsarikas, and encountered them at every step. They met also with friendly bands of Shoshones and Flatheads. After 1,000 troubles, they made some way upon their journey. On the 9th, they reached Wind River, a stream which gives its name to a range of mountains consisting of three parallel chains, 80 miles long and about 25 broad. One of its peaks, says the author, is probably 15,000 feet above the level of the sea. For 5 days, Mr. Hunt followed up the course of the Wind River, crossing and recrossing it. He had been assured by the three hunters who advised him to strike through the wilderness that by going up the river and crossing a single mountain ridge, he would come upon the headwaters of the Columbia. The scarcity of game, however, determined him to pursue a different course. In the course of the day, after coming to this resolve, they perceived three mountain peaks, white with snow, and which were recognized by the hunters as rising just above a fork of the Columbia. These peaks were named the Pilot Knobs by Mr. Hunt. The travelers continued their course for about 40 miles to the southwest, and at length found a river flowing to the west. This proved to be a branch of the Colorado. They followed its current for 15 miles. On the 18th, abandoning its main course, they took a northwesterly direction for 8 miles and reached one of its little tributaries, issuing from the bosom of the mountains and running through green meadows abounding in buffalo. Here they encamped for several days, a little repose being necessary for both men and horses. On the 24th, the journey was resumed. 15 miles brought them to a stream about 50 feet wide, which was recognized as one of the headwaters of the Columbia. They kept along it for 2 days, during which it gradually swelled into a river of some size. At length it was joined by another current, and both united swept off in an unimpeded stream, which, from its rapidity and turbulence, had received the appellation of Mad River. Down this they anticipated an uninterrupted voyage in canoes to the point of their ultimate destination, but their hopes were very far from being realized. The partners held a consultation. The three hunters who had hitherto acted as guides knew nothing of the region to the west of the Rocky Mountains. It was doubtful whether Mad River could be navigated, and they could hardly resolve to abandon their horses upon an uncertainty. The vote, nevertheless, was for embarkation, and they proceeded to build the necessary vessels. In the meantime, Mr. Hunt, having now reached the headwaters of the Columbia, reputed to abound in beaver, turned his thoughts to the main object of the expedition. Four men, Alexander Carson, Louis Saint-Michel, Pierre de Taillé, and Pierre Delaunay, were detached from the expedition to remain and trap beaver by themselves in the wilderness. Having collected a sufficient quantity of peltries, they were to bring them to the depot at the mouth of the Columbia, or to some intermediate post to be established by the company. These trappers had just departed when two Snake Indians wandered into the camp and declared the river to be unnavigable. Scouts sent out by Mr. Hunt finally confirmed this report. On the 4th of October, therefore, the encampment was broken up and the party proceeded to search for a post in possession of the Missouri Fur Company and said to be somewhere in the neighborhood upon the banks of another branch of the Columbia. This post they found without much difficulty. It was deserted, and our travelers gladly took possession of the rude buildings. The stream here found was upward of 100 yards wide. Canoes were constructed with all dispatch. In the meantime, another detachment of trappers was cast loose in the wilderness. These were Robinson, Reznor, Hoback, Carr, and Mr. Joseph Miller. This latter, it will be remembered, was one of the partners. He threw up his share of the expedition, however, for a life of more perilous adventure. On the 18th of the month, October, 15 canoes being completed, the voyagers embarked, leaving their horses in charge of the two Snake Indians who were still in company. In the course of the day, the party arrived at the junction of the stream upon which they floated with Mad River. Here, Snake River commences, the scene of 1,000 disasters. After proceeding about 400 miles by means of frequent portages and beset with innumerable difficulties of every kind, the adventurers were brought to a halt by a series of frightful cataracts, raging as far as the eye could reach between stupendous ramparts of black rock, rising more than 200 feet perpendicularly. This place they called the Cauldron Lynn. Here, Antoine Clapin, one of the voyageurs, perished amid the whirlpools. Three of the canoes struck immovably among the rocks, and one was swept away with all the weapons and effects of four of the boatmen.